certainly have a kapitel tonight worthy of transitioning us from Purim to Pesach. On Purim, which I hope everybody had a freilich in Purim.
Thank you.
And we had a wonderful, wonderful time. And we were very, of course,
simcha.
And now we have a kapitel almost depressing, which is going to talk about Gullus. And it's going to be a little bit different than our Purim learning has been. This is kapitel Pei Ches, which is 88. It is definitely a good transition from Purim to Pesach. Okay, so in Kapitel Pei Ches, now Kapitel Pei Ches was again written by the B'nai Korach. And the B'nai Korach, of course, were the sons of Korach who did Teshuvah and repented and regretted having followed their father in rebelling against Moshe Rabbeinu. And they were saved by landing, as everyone else fell into the pits of Gehenna, and they landed on a ledge. And they were given a gift by Hashem of being able to see into the future of Jewish history with some sort of vision or Ruach HaKodesh or Nevuah, however that worked. And they used that to write about various topics. And they used that, they were encouraged to see that just as Hashem would save the Jewish people, their father would also one day be redeemed and be able to do teshuva and take his rightful place amongst the leaders of the Jews. This particular kapitel describes the agonies of Gullus, the agonies of exile. And it's often said for Cholim. We'll see why as we go through it. And the purpose, I would say, is to remind a person not to be to be humble and not to have too much pride. And we'll talk a little at the end about what the purpose is, because as we go through the kapitel, we'll see it's a very unusual kapitel. There's very little talk of how Hashem was going to save us. It's mostly a description of how darn bad things are, which has a point, and we'll have to get to the point. It's a little bit long kapitel. There are 19 pesukim, so let's get started. Pasuk Aleph, verse 1, says, Shir Mizmor Livnei Korach, a song from the B'nai Korach, Lamanatzeach al machlis la'anos, on a machlis la'anos, which we'll see what that is, a maskil, an instructive kapitel, lehemen ha'ezrachi, that's not haman, in case you're still drinking, you have the wine for Purim in you, that is haman ha'ezrachi. Now the first thing is, who is haman ha'ezrachi? Now we don't seem to have heard too much about haman ha'ezrachi. In Divrei HaYomim, there are two different people named Haman mentioned, and it is a machlokis, an argument amongst the Rishonim, Rashi, and others as to which Haman this is referring to. However, to us, it makes not that much difference. One of the Haman was a Levi, and one was from the tribe of Yehuda. The only difference being as follows, that Haman was one of the top musical arrangers and musical experts at the time. And this would have been a time, let's say, contemporary or shortly after David HaMelech. The only question is whether Haman actually sung with the Levim or he only did the arranging. So if he was a Levi himself, he did all the musical arranging, and he was a musical prodigy, a genius. And the B'nai Korach wanted Haman, they saw there would be this amazing musical prodigy, and they wanted Haman to arrange this particular kapitel, the music for it. Now, if he was a Levi, he might have also sung with it. If he was from the tribe of Yehuda, he just did the arranging. So even though you're not a Levi, you're allowed to participate in the arranging and the musicology. You're just not allowed to sing with the Levium. Yes?
Does that mean that the sons of Korach wrote the words, the lyrics, and Haman composed the music?
Yes. Yes. That is exactly right. So they wrote the words on a scroll, but there was no particular tradition, I mean, how it's supposed to be sung. So Haman used his, and they saw that there would be this prodigy, they would have amazing gifts from Hashem in arranging music, and they wanted this particular kapitel, which is easily misunderstood and hard to follow, and has a lot of different things in it, is not a real straightforward kapitel, they wanted Haman to arrange this. Right? So they specifically said, now, we weren't sure which of the two Hamans they're referring to. Somebody named Haman did arrange it, but there are two people around that time living that were called Haman.
Were they both geniuses?
And we don't know which one was the musical genius, but It's a little unclear from the psukim there. Rashi's of the opinion that it was the one that was not a Levi, and other reforshim of the opinion that it was the one that was a Levi. The really only difference is whether he could sing with them or not. Because sometimes people are under the misconception that if you're not a Levi, you can't have anything to do with the Levim's performances. And that's not really true. The arrangers, the composers, the conductors, everybody except the actual singers can be anybody. Right? Only Levium could sing. So he could have very well been the arranger, the music writer, the conductor, etc., and never sung. Right? So some of them, of course, say, well, he must have been the Levi Haman, because he's with the... But others say, well, no, maybe he didn't sing. He stood there after he arranged the music. You know, Beethoven didn't sing along with his composition, did he? All right? You know, he didn't sit there going, and he didn't do that. So he doesn't have to have sung with it. But however, they saw there was this musical prodigy, Haman, and because of the complexity and difficulty of this capital, they wanted this special guy to arrange it. So they wrote that, and then he arranged it musically. Now, what's a machlas la'anos? So we sort of know some of those words. I mean, a machla can be a sickness. La'anos can mean to afflict. Like on Yom Kippur, we have a yim that we afflict ourselves. So some people say that a machlas la'anos is a sick person who was cured. And that's one of the reasons we say this kapitzel for sick people. You see more later. The Me'iri, who often holds along these lines, says that a machla is an instrument, musical instrument. And a musical instrument that makes a person feel like they're being afflicted and feel so sad and depressed that they want to do teshuvah. It's a depressing sounding instrument. And or it's a sick person. But already you see where we're going. It's the first verse is not opening with a big happy thing here. It's either a sick person or an instrument that makes you feel sick.
Mm-hmm. Right. Show us for the answer.
For what?
When you answer someone in Hebrew.
Oh, right. That is.
Couldn't it be looked at that this is a song for someone who's sick that's answered? Instead of afflicted?
The Meforshim also refers to afflicted. But a sick person who was cured could very well be a machal la'anos. Right? But they say it means afflicted, but it does have the same letters as to answer. So certainly from a philosophical standpoint, we could say that. A machla, and then he was answered.
I mean, that would make sense to me. That's why you would say this for someone who's ill.
Right. Well, we're going to see also in the kapitel that it talks about all the terrible things that happen to a person.
How could the contemporary sons live during Moshe's time?
Correct.
And lived much later.
Correct. It would have been like 400 or 500 years later. Correct.
So how could they say? Open in the time of Haman or something?
Well, they handed down the scrolls, and David had the scroll, and he knew that there would be an arranger named Haman, and who should arrange this.
They
saw through their vision that Hashem gave them that there would be a person, Haman, who was such a musical prodigy that he would be worthy of arranging this composition.
So they didn't write something, no, to be put to music by Haman. They did.
They put Haman's name in there, sure.
They did?
Sure, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, Haman, you know, we look at that, wow, what an unusual name. How many Hamans could there have been running around? But, I mean, in the Yavam, there's two Hamans, and we don't even know which is which. It wasn't that uncommon of a name. Mm-hmm. Right? It would be like saying, this should be arranged by a guy named David. You know, well, that could be thousands of different people. Mm-hmm. So we look at it and say, well, there must have only been one Haman in the entire world. It's probably not true. There are probably a lot of people named Haman. And David had the scroll, and when Haman, the musical prodigy, arrived, aha! A lot of times when they write something like this, the meaning isn't clear until later. Or as they said, this is a maskil for Haman HaEzrahi. Right? Now maybe that means that, you know, what does that mean? Is that all of a sudden here comes the musical prodigy Haman, who's in charge of arranging compositions, and you realize, aha, that's what they meant. A lot of times you have that in verse where it's not clear. It's talking about something that will happen in the future, and it's only clear after the thing happens what it really means. Because right? They didn't leave detailed instructions. In the year XYZ, there will be this guy. He lives at 123 Rehov David HaMelech, and you should go get the, you know. They didn't leave. All he had was a scroll, and the scroll said in it, Haman, Ezrahi. Right? So when there became a musical prodigy named Haman, it became obvious then what they were referring to. Until then, probably wasn't clear who they were referring to.
What's Ha'az Rachi?
That is a great question. That is a great question. And I'm going to actually skip that question because a lengthy answer, because nobody agrees. All right? Nobody, the Mefarshim all discuss what an Ezrachi is. And there's about 14 or 15 different opinions on what an Ezrachi is. And whether he's from a certain place or at a certain trade. There's a whole lot of different opinions as to what an Ezrachi is. So in the interest of the fact that it's a long capital, I'm going to skip over that. But it was an excellent question. I'm sorry that I'm not going to give you an excellent answer. In verse 2, Pasuk Beis, it says, Hashem Elokei Yeshua Si, Hashem is the God of my salvation, Yom Sakti V'Laila Negdecha. By day I cried out, and by night I stood before you. So by day I cried out, means that during the day, Rav Hirsch explains as follows, during the day, when a person is in Gullus, they're off doing their work and their labor and their parnasa, etc. Only when a person comes home belila does he feel close to Hashem. When he comes home at night and he's with his family, or he's davening and he's learning and he's doing the more spiritually oriented things. So during the day I'm screaming out, I have to go do whatever, whatever, whatever. And at night, negdecha, I feel close to you. But while I'm out during the day doing my worldly, earning a living things, whether it's farming or trade or whatever, I don't feel as close. I'm screaming, you know what? I don't want to have to do this anymore. But once I get home, Belila, I feel close to you. Now, Zakti, a screaming out, is of course a famous thing. When we were in Mitzrayim, we screamed out, Hashem heard us. And the Al-Sheikh points out that this is an allusion to the fact that just as we screamed and Hashem always redeemed us from every other exile, so too He will redeem us from this exile. In verse 3, Pasuk Gimel, says, Tavo lefanecha tefilasi, my prayer should come before you, hate aznecha lerinasi, bend your ear to my cries. This is how it translates, it cries here. We'll see in a minute whether it's a good translation or not. Let my tefillah come before you. That's sort of a funny wording to say. When he's trying to say, let my tefillah come before you, I realize that given my situation here in Gullus, and given my how much I'm occupied with the physical just existence, I don't always daven, perhaps, with the best kavanah that I should. I don't always daven as if I was standing by the entrance to the Beis HaMikdash. Nonetheless, let my tefillahs come up anyway. You know, you daven to Hashem, I don't know about you, I always second-guess myself. I could have had more kavanah, I could have done this, I could have, you know, after Yom Kippur, oh, forgot about this sin. Okay. For me, anyway, the list of things I forgot is almost as long as the list of sins I did. So, but this is a tefillah saying, let my tefillah be good enough. I tried my best, let that tefillah be good enough, even if on an objective scale, even if Hashem, you're grading this on a 1 to 100, it's like a 60, you should give me credit for the fact that I tried, and that my best efforts, so let my tefillah come up to Hashem, right, and lend your ears, lirinasi, it translates to my cry. Now, rina is like joy, happiness. Right? So it seems like the pasuk should be translated, lend your ear to my joy. And in fact, many Mefarshim do translate it exactly that way, because lend your ear to my joy means that whenever I daven and involve my neshama, I always feel joyful just because I'm talking to Hashem. Even if I'm davening and there's some terrible circumstances and I need all kinds of refuahs and yeshuas, I feel rina just because I'm close to Hashem. So lend your ear to my rina. Lend your ear to my joy. Now, Rav Hirsch says something very deep. And he says that rina, we always translate as joy. He says rina really is the neshama's response to anything that happens to a person. And he says, we translate rina as joy because when we go to a chasana or we go to some joyous occasion, our neshama feels that and we feel joyous, we feel happy. He said, rina is how your neshama is always supposed to respond to things. And that's why we call it joy. But really, if you go to a chasana and you feel sad because you're not married, let's say, a person who's not married goes to a chasana, and they feel, I mean, they're happy, but they feel a little tinge of, when am I going to get married already? So I've heard says, that's Rina too. It's just not full, it's not the Rina that it should be. Your response should be Rina. But your response is sad. Well, he says, we call that Rina also. He said, the reason we translate it as joy is that's what your response is supposed to be. So, in general usage, Rina is translated as joy. But his point is that a person can go to an experience where they're supposed to feel Rina, and out comes something else. And he says, to him, that's still called Rina, because that's what you responded with. So he says that when it says, lend your ear to my Rina, means lend your ear to my neshama's outpouring of feeling for Hashem. The simple translation would not be cries or would not be refers. The simple translation would be, lend your ears to my joy. I want my tefillas to go up to you no matter how objectively good they are, and I'm happy that I'm talking to you, so lend your ear to my Rina. He goes on in the next pasuk, Kisava v'raos nafshi, my neshama is full of bad things, v'chaya lishol higiu, and my life has reached the graveside. Or what we call lishol higiu also means the lower world. It means that I'm so full of bad things and my life has reached the lower world that I'm so beaten down by my miseries and my troubles and my difficulties that I basically have no more interest in anything physical or in doing anything. I'm so worn down and so beaten down. I'm so full. Sava is like satiated. I'm satiated with all the bad things of my neshama. I have no more room for any other desires. What?
Who is the I?
I is the we Jewish people.
Oh, okay.
I'm so satiated with these bad things that are happening to me that I feel like I'm all the way down in Gehenna already. I have no interest anymore in anything. Tell me, you know, there's a good kugel in the refrigerator for you. I'm not interested. Talking about here is a depressed person. Person who's dragged down so far, I have no interest in anything anymore. He goes on to say, Nachshavti im yordei vor. I'm one of those people, like I've fallen in a pit. Ayisi kineged ein oil. I'm like a helpless person. Israel has no strength, no energy to respond to anything. No. No, it's going to get more depressing. No energy to respond to your enemies. You're dragged down already that your enemies come and they say, we want you to do this, we're kicking you out of this, we're doing this. You don't have the koach, you don't have the energy to respond. Enough, all right, fine, whatever.
What does Ayel mean?
No hope for. It's written off. It says, b'meisim chavshi. I'm like a dead person, kimo chalalim shochvei kever. Like corpses lying in the grave, the shaloz acharta mode, and nobody remembers him. The hema miyadcha nigzaru, and have been severed and cut off by your hand. Talking about these people, I'm dead. I'm free. Nobody means dead and he's free. So he has nothing more in this world. Feels like he's already dead. Nothing more in this world, and is remembered no more. So remember, we have the story in the Chumash, the Chalal, the guy who went out. And died and nobody remembered him. It feels like that. He's dead and nobody's going to even remember who he was. He says, your hand cut me off. There's a slight bit of optimism. Since your hand cut me off, you could bring me back. But right now I feel like I'm dead. I have nothing less from this world. Nobody's going to remember me. You cut me off with your hand. Maybe you'll bring me back. Shatani v'bor atios v'mashkavim mitzolos. The next verse, in verse 7, you put me in the lowest pit, in the darkest depths. The lowest pit, the darkest depths. I mean, it's dark, it's deep, it's dark, dark is dark. Well, that's not really true. If you ask someone who was in Russia and was imprisoned by the KGB, they'll tell you that prisons have levels to them. Even though you're down underground, the lower down you go, the worse the prison is. You know, the worst prisoner interrogations and beatings took place in the lowest levels. So he's saying, I feel like I've already not only gone into the prison, into the dungeon, I've gone down to the very, very lowest levels possible. That's what I feel my life is like, he says. And in verse 8, he says, Alai samcha hamasecha. You leaned your anger against me. V'chol mishbarecha inisi sela. And you tortured me to the maximum with every strike. Hirchakta miyudai,
you distanced my allies, my friends from me, many. Shatani soevos. You made me an abomination. You made me look like an abomination to them. Velo etze. And I can't get out. I have no escape. So you distance my allies from me. There are two different opinions in the Rishonim what the allies are. One opinion is that it's the other nations of the world. Remember, at one time with David and Shlomo, Israel was top of the world. Everybody wanted to be our pals and our buddies. Now, you know, the tiniest, weakest nation in the world can be anti-Semitic and nothing happens. So you've distanced our allies from me. Most of the Mephoshim say, though, you've distanced my allies from me, refers one Jew to another. You know, we joke about it, that there's five Jews, anywhere you get five Jews, there's 10 opinions. And it's funny. He says, it's not so funny. He says, Hashem has made our lives so difficult, right, in Galus, and things so difficult that I feel like even my own Jewish friends maybe aren't really on my side anymore. And we joke about it, but that's what he's talking about. And in fact, you've made me abominable. I know. Who would have thought in the days of David and Shlomo that Jews would once again come to the point where they would hate each other? They thought that was in the past. We've gotten everything now. We've gotten the base of Mikdash. We've got our king. Everything's great. Who'd have thought they'd come to such a point again? The Sephorno says an interesting thing. He says, Meyuda'ai is translated here as friends, but it's from the word root like Yodea, to be known. And he says that in the times of Israel's greatness, we had many, many famous scholars and accomplished people that were known throughout the world and respected. And he said, nowadays, the biggest Talmud Chacham the Jewish people have by the other nations is not respected. We don't have any more the respect of those people. We don't have any Meyudais, any people that can be respected by the rest of the world. Goes on in verse 10 to say, Einai de'avam mimi aini karasicha Hashem b'chol yom shitachti elecha kapai. My eye is saddened by all these tortures. Hashem, I call out to you daily and I stretch my hand out to you. Stretching his hand out is actually a reference to davening. In the old days, it was common for people to raise their hands when they davened. Now, we don't do that in our times, because it's become something very popular amongst the non-Jewish people. So therefore, already 1,000 years ago, the Jews pretty much stopped doing that. There's no real halacha that says raise your hands or don't raise your hands in general, but because it's something that non-Jews do, it fell out of favor amongst Jews. But back here, he's saying, I'm raising out my hands as an expression of davening. As I call out to you, daily. Now look at what he says here. He says that the oni, krasicha, you made me, it's translated here as torture. The word oni, of course, is also referred to as a poor person. The Talmud tells us that poverty is the hardest suffering to bear. That a poor person is compared to being dead in the Talmud. That poverty is the hardest thing for a person to bear of all the afflictions that Hashem could send him. But poverty also is a powerful motivator. There's a story, I'm not sure where this story comes from. I saw it in the Ma'am Lo'ed, I'm not sure where it comes from exactly, that there was a chassid. Now, we're talking about a chassid in the story. We don't mean a person in a shtraimel. We mean in the old days, the days of the Talmud, a very pious person was called a chassid. It wasn't an expression of you're a chassidish person and whether you wear a shtraimel or not. It was an expression meaning that a very, very devout person was called a chassid. So there was a certain chassid who was very, very poor. He literally had to scrounge through the streets to try and find something to eat. But he davened with tremendous kavana. He was very, very strong in his emuna of Hashem. So Eliyahu HaNavi, goes the story, saw this poor fellow and felt bad for him. This is the poorest person I've ever seen. So Eliyahu HaNavi came to him and said, Rav Yid, if I were to give you two coins, would that help you? And he said, if you give me two coins, I could start a business, I could trade, I could, you know, get something going. So Eliyahu HaNavi gave him two coins. He went and he bought something, he traded that, and he handled for that, and he, you know, imported this from China, and he did this, and he did that. And eventually he had a very nice business going, and became a relatively wealthy fellow. How do you think his davening fared after that? Nowhere near what it was when he was poor. So Hashem called Eliyahu and Navi on the carpet and said, I had one chassid in the world and you stole him from me. Why did you do that? So Eliyahu and Navi took the coins back. The man became poor again and his davening was increased. So Eliyahu and Navi felt bad for him again. They're going to go round in a circle, round and round and round. So Eliyahu and Navi came back to him and said, I'll give you the two coins if you swear a shavuot to me that you'll always stay a chassid. And the moral of the story is supposed to be, the point of the story is that without that shavua, those two coins alone made the man unable to be a chassid anymore. So we have poverty as a very dual-edged sword. There's nothing worse than poverty in terms of a person's affliction. But it's a powerful motivator. When we talk about people sitting in Europe and learning all day, it wasn't because they had mountains of money to pay their bills. It was because they didn't have anything. Right? They had no food, no money, so no job. So they had a lot of time. It's a powerful motivator. It's also the worst possible thing the worst that can afflict you. Worse than any illness, worse than anything, is poverty. The truth is, I don't know if in America we really understand the kind of poverty that they experienced in these kind of times. I mean, in the rest of the story, it goes into details that he would, you know, sometimes find in the garbage bin one, you know, scrap of apple a day to eat. That kind of poverty we don't really see. Baruch Hashem, we don't really see that kind of poverty, but that's the kind of poverty that they're talking about. Right? That that's how he feels, that Hashem has given him that much affliction that he's like the guy scrounging through the garbage can. In verse 11, he says, I'm sorry, some of the Hebrew numbers are cut off there, but it's Halameisim, Tase Pela, Imrifayim Yakumu Yaduchu Sela. You're going to perform a wonder for the dead. Will the lifeless ever rise and thank you? Now, it's not literally talking about dead people, but it's referring to you do all kinds of things for Rishayim. Here I am. I'm sitting. I'm feeling depressed, everything. And I see this wicked guy down there in his Jaguar, all right, in his Lexus. How does that help make a Kiddush Hashem in the world? All right, is he going to go and is he going to daven, thank you very much, Hashem? How's that going to help? I suffer bekever chazdecha munasecha ba'avadon in the next pasuk. Will your kindness be spoken of in the grave, your faithfulness in the netherworld? Well, this guy goes to Gehenna and he gets his punishment. How is that going to make a Kiddush Hashem? Meanwhile, us, your trusted, loyal servants, both as a nation and individually, are suffering. Will your wonders become known only in the places of darkness? It's a strong language. Talking back to Hashem here. Your wonders are going to become known where? In Gehenna. They're all going to be talking about you in Gehenna. Where all these people are doing averos, yeah, that's where they're going to remember you, Hashem. But remember me, because there's the next pasuk in 14. Vani elecha, Hashem. Shivati vavokra tefilasi tekadmecha. I screamed out to you, and my prayer greets you every morning. Every morning, before I do anything, I dive into Hashem. So the people who don't do that and go to Gehenna, those are the people that you want to be screaming about Hashem? That's not a Kiddush Hashem. Why don't you do that for us? We come every morning and we dive into you. On to the next page in verse 15. Lama Hashem... Oh, I got it the opposite way this time, sorry. Lama Hashem tiznach nafshi tastir panach mimeni. Why do you forsake me? Why do you hide your presence from me? What is the point of letting us perish? Now, in verse 14, he uses two expressions. He uses the expression of shivati, I called out, and sorry, second to last my place. One second. Okay, so he's talking about here shivati, I called out. When earlier in the pasukim, he's talking about zaka, to scream out. So Shava and Tzaka, we often see used. The people cried out to Hashem, a Tzaka Gedolah, a great cry, a great scream. And here he says, Shivati, I called to you. So Shivati is a lower level kind of scream. Shivati is when you're screaming out what you want. Hashem, I want something, and you're screaming it out. A Tzaka Gedolah, a cry, a great cry, is where you're so in pain that you can't articulate what you want, all you can do is cry out. Chazal say that the most amazing tefillah is a person who is shaviti, he's crying out so much that he can no longer ask Hashem for what he wants, and it's just a tzaka gedola. When it says that the Jews had a great scream out to Hashem, that's what it means. We're davening, we want, we want, we want, we want, until no more can we even articulate what we want, and we're just screaming, ah, help us! That's tzaka gedola. That's a great cry that went up. We couldn't even ask for what we wanted anymore. Chazal tells us that's a powerful tefillah. When Hashem heard a tzaka gedola, you can't ignore a tzaka gedola. A great scream. In verse 16, he says, Ani ani, I'm a poor person, the gaveya minoar, and nazati emecha afuna, I've been on the verge, I've always been on the verge of death, and I've always feared you. So, once a person's born, death is inevitable. So he says, listen, I've always been on the edge of death, and I've always feared you. But what's happened, he says in the next verse, alai avru charonecha, your anger overcome me. You washed over me with your anger and punished me. V'vesechad seems to suni. And your scariness, your fright has beat on me, has beaten me down. Savuni kamayim kol hayom, they encircle me like waters every day. Hipiku alai yachad, they all surround me. You're giving me nothing but sorrows day after day after day. Like, it's like water. You're getting the water, it's all around you. No matter which way you turn, there's still water. You've sent away, you've distanced from me my friend, and I am nothing but darkness to all who know me. Sending away my friend is referring to Mashiach, and I'm darkness to everyone who knows me is referring to the loneliness, both as a nation individually, in Gullis. And that's the end of the kapitel. Where's the words of encouragement? What happened to the but Hashem will save me part? Now, I know many of us have, this is not our first kapitel that we've learned. And we usually see a certain pattern that even when the kapitel is reminding us of our deep troubles, there's always a point that okay, you have these deep troubles, but don't worry, Hashem's coming to the rescue. Now, I didn't leave that off of the photocopies. There's no Hashem coming to the rescue here. That's the end of what the B'nai Korach wrote. The Mefarshim struggle with why the B'nai Korach ended on such a sad and depressing note. It's very uncommon in the Kapitulach. You see David HaMelech ending on a sad and depressing note, usually. I mentioned in the beginning that the point of the Kapitul is to take away a person's pride and remind them to be humble. Mefarshim explain that the Jews, we were meant to live in Eretz Yisrael as a light amongst the nations. But we failed. How did we fail? We became obsessed with distractions. Most notably, we became obsessed with material success. Eretz Yisrael is a land of milk and honey. It's a land that can be very rich and rewarding. And we enjoyed the material success we had. During the times of David and Shlomo, we were the richest, most successful nation in the world. Everybody wanted to emulate us. I think I might have mentioned before that during the times of David HaMelech, they refused to take any converts because it was so great to be a Jew, and you could be instantly so successful that they had no way to ascertain whether or not a person wishing to convert was sincere. It's just impossible. Because no matter how much they claim to be sincere, to be a Jew would immediately put you on top of the world, and they just couldn't determine whether or not the people were sincere. They said, no more converts. Well, after David, at least with David and Shlomo, they directed our desires for material success into proper channels. We're going to build a base of Mikdash that's going to stun the world. But after that, the kingdom split. So we still had that great deal for, desire for material success, but we didn't really channel it very well. And so we got involved in a little Avodah Zarah. And we sort of forgot what was important. So Hashem said, I'll tell you what, I'm going to help you out. I'm going to remind you. I'm going to send you into exile. And when you're in exile, I assure you, you will not be able to think about material success. You'll only be able to think about how bad things are, and you'll realize, aha, I was focusing on the wrong thing, I meaning the Jewish people, and exile has taught me that lesson. How's that working for us? Not all that well. We still think about material success. And you know what? We equate material success with happiness. We equate physical things with happiness. People think they're happy if they have a nice house, and they have a car, and they have nice clothes, and this and that. Walk up and down the streets of, it doesn't have to be Chicago, walk up and down the streets of any Jewish neighborhood in any city, and you have to watch out because you're going to wear a hard hat from all the houses that are being torn down and bigger houses built in their place. Now, it could be that's a necessary thing for a family, or it could be they're focusing on the wrong things. We think that we can be Torah observant, frum Jews, and still have the best of the material world. That's what we think. We think that you can be a servant of Hashem and have the best of the material world. You can have your cake and eat it too. Says the B'nai Korach, wrong, wrong, wrong. It does not work that way. Right? Open up right now. It's after Purim, right? Open up any Jewish newspaper. What do you see ads for? Pesach vacations. Right? Now, okay, you know what? I'm not going to get into whether Pesach vacations are a good idea or not. Depends on the individual circumstances. For some people it's good, some people it's not. But what are they advertising? Beautiful view of Italian hills. Beautiful view. Compare how many advertise a beautiful view of Europe versus how many advertise a beautiful view of Yerushalayim. I think you'll find that very few are advertising a beautiful view of Yerushalayim compared to how many are advertising a beautiful view of Europe. Because we want to be frum and have our cake and eat it too. We are going to go to some place in Europe and we are going to have glatt kosher food and the best matzah that money can buy. And we're going to use our miles to upgrade. And we're going to have a terrific time and we are going to go and observe Hashem's Torah in the middle of who knows where. And we're going to have our cake and eat it too. Wrong, said the B'nai Korach. Doesn't work that way. B'nai Korach says there is one type of happiness in the world and one type only. And that is the happiness that comes from doing a mitzvah. Simchas HaMitzvah. When we forget that, when we think that material things can bring happiness, now let me just be clear, I'm not advocating poverty. Poverty is a terrible thing. But the B'nai Korach are reminding us there's an attitude towards physical possessions and towards material things. Physical possessions and material things are to be used to further the goal of being a light amongst the nations. Nobody says you should live in the street. But are you buying a house because it has enough bedrooms for your children? Or are you buying a house because you're going to get a great geschmack over what a wonderful, terrific, nifty, great house you have? So if it's the former, it's a mitzvah house. If it's the latter, it's you want to have, listen, I'm material, listen, I can have this great house, and you know what? I paid for it with a loan that had a heter iska. All right, and I didn't pay any interest, and I did everything, and my kitchen has been scrubbed down to the molecules so that it's kosher. And that, now I'm a happy person. Say the B'nai Korach, yeah, you think you are, right? But you're really not. There's only one kind of happiness. And if you forget, say the B'nai Korach, that kind of happiness, all right, what that is, Hashem will remind you. Hashem will remind you, and you'll be in a dark prison underworld. And they go on further to say, you can be in a dark prison underworld no matter where we think we are. But they have, the Pasuk here talks about a person who's dragged down and depressed. Look at America, what a material success we are. How could you be depressed? If happiness is related to material things, then we are going to throw out all the Prozac in the world. And we're going to close every mental health clinic there is. Because in America, we don't need it anymore, right? We're all happy. We got material success. So since happiness is related to material success, it must be that everybody in America is happy. Is that how it works? How could a person then have material success and not be happy? Because they've misidentified happiness. They've misidentified happiness. This person that the B'nai Korach are talking about in Klal Yisrael, when they're talking about being dragged down to the netherworld, you think they had a place to live. But they're down in the netherworld because they're focused on the wrong things. A person can be in this pit, in this lower underworld, and be in the middle of New York in a fancy mansion. Because if your focus is wrong on what makes a person happy, say the B'nai Korach, it doesn't matter how much stuff you have. It doesn't matter. You're in exile. You're in Gullis, and you're going to feel terrible. You're going to feel terrible. You're going to feel like you're in the lowest depths of the underworld. How is that possible? Because you think these things should make you happy, and they don't. So, Hashem, how could you do this to me? Hashem's like, listen, I sent you into Gullis so you could remember what's important. And if you remember what's important and happy, and be happy, then we can all come home. Well, I like to always tell the mashal about the king, and the son grew up in the palace, and he was very spoiled, and he thought that, you know, dinner just appears magically on a plate every night. So the king sent him out to live amongst the peasants, to see how what life is about. And when he comes back, he appreciates things. Right? Hashem sent us out to live amongst the peasants, right? And we said, I know, we'll build a nice hut here. And we forgot that we lived in the house of the king, that that's what made us happy. B'nai Korach don't end on a happy note, because their point is that you can have all of these things. You can be feel like in the netherworld of the lowest pit, that you're dead, right? That you feel dead, right? It's still simple, some mitzvah. Person still be happy. It doesn't say anywhere here they're not happy. The physical conditions are miserable. They're miserable. I feel like Hashem has rejected them. But there's no ways, this is B'nai Korach's point, that you can say, I'm going to be a frum person, and I'm going to combine that with material success, and that's what will make me happy. If you do that, you're in the dark dungeons no matter what. The message here is subtle and tricky, yet at the same time beating you over the head. We all know this about America. We all know that it's a temptation, you know, to get involved in riches. Rav Shimon Schwab, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, when he came to America, said he didn't understand why people spoke negatively about businessmen. He said when he was in Europe, a businessman meant you worked during the day in your either in your trade or in your fields or whatever until you had enough food for the day, and then you went back to the Beis Medrash. So what was so wrong with being involved in business? And I told him, Rabbi, you don't understand. Here, business is a whole ASIC. You got to work 24-6 to make as much money as possible and to become as rich as possible. And he didn't believe them. That's not possible. Right? There's no way that's how people think. And he came and he saw, sure enough, that's how people think. There's a pellet at Chofetz Chaim. This is not a halacha lemaisa. He says, don't balance your checkbook. Don't balance your checkbook. I personally try and be Mekayim, this is Chofetz Chaim, on a regular basis. I've never been able to balance my checkbook, so I feel that I'm following the words of the Chofetz Chaim. But he says, you know what? If you want Hashem to take care of things, let Hashem take care of things. You want to look in and see how much money you have, so fine, you'll be in charge. If you want to rely on Hashem, then rely on Hashem. If you want to go out and say, you know what, I'm going to put so much money, I'm going to work, I'm going to get more money in here, and that's going to make me happy, Hashem says, fine, go be happy. Do what you think is going to make you happy. The only real happiness comes from doing a mitzvah and depending on Hashem. I'll close one other story, which is slightly related at least, hopefully. I once heard a Rav give a speech, and I would say this Rav is known as a pretty good speaker. He speaks on a regular basis, you know, various places in the country. And I happened to be there, and he got up and he gave the most amazing speech I have ever heard in my life to this day. And I say with no trace of irony, I've heard many speeches from many Ravs, right, and many drushes, and many shuls, and I've never heard anybody speak like this. And he's never spoken like that before or after. So you could have heard a pin drop when he finished. I think people would have begged him to go on. Now, I don't know about you, but in my shul, people don't usually beg the Rav to go on. Right? So I was just dying of curiosity. And I went over to him and I said, excuse me, Rebbe, but how did you come up with this? You should hear the places like, could have a pin drop for the last 40 minutes. He said, well, I'll tell you. It's an interesting story. He said, I wasn't supposed to speak today. I was here and Rav so-and-so was supposed to speak. And about 5 minutes before the drusha, someone came in to get Rav so-and-so. It was a family emergency. And he left. I had nothing planned to say. So I stood up and I said a quick tefillah to Hashem and I started talking. And he said, I really actually couldn't repeat over to you what I said. Because someone said, we should write this down. This was amazing ideas he had, you know, and amazing motivations. I don't know what I said. I said, Rebbe, you just spoke for 40 minutes. You're supposed to speak for 20, by the way. You just spoke for 40 minutes, and nobody minded. And it was the greatest drasha we ever heard in our lifetimes, and people will be talking about it for 20 years. What do you mean you don't remember? I have no idea what I said. I said, I got up, and there was an emergency situation, right? And I knew that somebody's supposed to speak. And there's only two choices, and the guy who was supposed to speak left. And he said, I'm sorry, I have to go, to a family emergency, you'll have to speak, bye. And You know, he says, a lot of times I have something in mind just in case, you know, when you're a rav, you go to places, they ask you to speak, and you, oh, yes, that reminds me of, you know, well, of course, he thought about that in the car on the way over, maybe. Or he didn't have anything to say. He doesn't remember what he said to this day. Right? Because relying on Hashem for your happiness is the same as relying on Hashem for everything else. You rely on Hashem, and you know that Hashem gives you food, and Hashem does all this. Why don't you rely on Hashem for your happiness? Says the B'nai Korach. You rely on Hashem for everything else, but for your happiness, you know what? I'll take care of that. So that's what the Chofetz Chaim is saying. Well, you don't have to take care of it. Hashem will take care of everything else too. Hashem takes care of your food. Hashem takes care of your health. Right? When you're sick, you go to the doctor and you dive into Hashem. Hopefully in the other order. You dive into Hashem and go to the doctor, right?
Right.
So when you want to be happy, you go ask 12 years old, and we're going to get a new car. You get a new car, you get that nice new car smell, whatever that comes from, I don't know, and you're driving it around, you do feel a little happy, right? In fact, you make a Shechianu, and you have this gevaldik new car. That's how you got your happiness. Hello? I'm feeling a little down today. I'm not going to buy a new car, right? How about I ask Hashem for my happiness, too? That's what the B'nai Korach are trying to say. Forget the idea that combining material success with your Jewishness is going to somehow make you a happy person. What's going to make you a happy person is happiness is going to come from Hashem. And if you don't ask Hashem for your happiness, you end up in the lowest pits of the low, whether you're an ani, like it says here, or whether you're the richest person in America. If you don't ask Hashem for your happiness, you're not going to have it. A view of the Italian Alps, or Swiss Alps, or, I'm sorry about that, a view of the Alps, wherever they may be, I'm going to edit that out of the tape, a view of the Alps, wherever they may be, all right, is beautiful. That's not happiness. Unless you're davening to Hashem to help me appreciate the world and give me happiness, and Hashem says, oh, you want happiness? Look at these beautiful mountains I made. And you say, oh, those are beautiful mountains. Good job, Hashem. If you go there, where are you going for Pesach? I'm going to blah, blah, and it's gorgeous there. Okay. So get your happiness from there, says Hashem. And then they come back, and they're depressed. What do you mean you're depressed, and you have this wonderful vacation? Yeah. Have you ever seen anybody come back from vacation and they're depressed? I've seen that all the time. That's happened to me. You come back, a vacation is supposed to uplift you, right? So instead, you come back depressed. And you say, oh, well, it's because I have to go back to work now. No, it's depressed because you thought vacation was what was going to make you happy. And the vacation will make you happy if you're asking Hashem to make you happy. Maybe Hashem will say, fine, go on a vacation. But asking Hashem for happiness and to make you happy and have that simchas hamitzvah and realize that that's the real simcha, then you'll never be in the netherworlds. You'll never be like a dead person. It doesn't matter whether you're poor or rich or whatever. It won't matter. You won't have any of these ideas that you can bring about your own happiness through material things. Ask Hashem for your happiness, and he'll say, I'll give you simchas hamitzvah, and you'll be a happy, well-adjusted individual. The B'nai Korach's secret to mental health. Right? That's the B'nai Korach's secret to mental health. That's the meaning of this kapitel. And the four seem struggle, but they're coming at it. The B'nai Korach, when they see history, they see, they're not just seeing events and wars and things, they see the whole Jewish people, and they see they see what's happening to them. As someone once said very wisely, probably others have said it too, we've been in Galus a long time. And it doesn't get any easier. Right? So Be'ezus Hashem, as we come out of Purim and into Pesach, which is a sort of different mindset, we want to come to Pesach with that right idea that our happiness comes from Simchas HaMitzvah and from the fact that Hashem took us out of Mitzrayim, etc., etc. That's what our happiness comes from, not from the fact that we get a beautiful view of the Swiss Alps. Any questions?
Thank you.
So the question is, are they saying this in Palm Beach?
In Palm Beach?
This seems to be line up very, very consistently with the Bernie Madoff situation.
Mr. Madoff, because everybody was striving to be happy with all that, he thought he would get happy if he had millions and millions more dollars.
The people that invested with him were not that they wanted a better deal than they really could get.
Mm-hmm.
They trusted, you know, with their ally. They trusted, they thought this was a nice Jewish guy, mm-hmm. their ally. Turned against them.
And how much happier will I be if I can get a 20% return on my money instead of 10? That'll make me really happy.
And now, like Eliyahu the Navi taking away the coins.
So now he's taking away the coins.
Vanished.
And there are most of us in there to show that went out of business. They had $1 million invested, and they lived off of the $80,000, $100,000 a year interest, and that was their. That's how the organization's closed up. There are people that don't have what to eat because of that. And so, you know, so an organization that took a hit, they can maybe raise more money or do something, but there are especially small organizations that was their entire, you know, they raised this $1 million, they invested it with this fine, trustworthy fellow, right? And everybody told them, well, wow, you can get a 10% return, and no, we can get a 20% return with this guy. Simchas HaMitzvah, that's the only true happiness that there is. Any other questions? Okay. And you should, if you want to be happier, yes. If you want something to make you happy, you should do a mitzvah and feel happy from it. And if that doesn't come easily, that's what you have to work on. That's the avoda. Of instead of saying, you know what, I need something to make me feel happy, I'm going to buy a new car. I need something to make me feel happy, I'm going to help some chassid organization. I don't know, just making up an example. I mean, there's a lot of mitzvahs you could do, but it could be anything. I remember once actually, there was a person, anonymous person, not me, but another anonymous person, who was having a rough couple of weeks, whatever, and they went over when they were having the clothing drive at the Chicago Chassid Farm, and they bagged all this clothing. Standing there talking about the clothing into bags, and if you've ever been over there seeing them doing it, doesn't really look like a very fun job. They have to sort out the boys' clothes and the girls' clothes, and you know, people pull up and toss out all their clothes, and you know, some of the clothes you have to sort of decide maybe that one's not gonna be so usable. All right, he came back in a much better mood. This horrible job, right? Wouldn't he be better off at the ice cream shop? Right? No, but he came back. He didn't even know why, right? But he just came back and he was happier. Right? Got a little mitzvah.
Just like when I come to this class. I don't miss from rain or shine.
Orej of Chizuk as we go into Pesach.